There was a long, dreadful silence. "It stopped," said Garcia in a whisper.
"Did they get it? Did they get it?"
Waters whimpered. The silence stretched on. Garcia clutched the shotgun, its pump and trigger guard slick from sweat. 5 or 6 shots, that's all he'd heard, and the creature had killed a heavily armed SWAT team.
"Did they get it?"
Waters asked again. Garcia listened intently, but could hear nothing from the hall. This was the worst of all, the brief raising, then dashing of his hopes. He waited. There was a rattling at the door.
"No,"
whispered Garcia.
"It's back."
The Relic by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Welcome to Monstoberfest.
Well, Lynn, I'll start and then we can slate. We've done slate for 140 some odd episodes. Let's just stick with it this time. God, we're off our game.
Right. Yeah, we need to do. Do we have enough vocal warm up? Lion face, lemon face.
Oh, wow! Rub a baby buggy bumpers.
Sleepy time tea is not the kind Joe Rogan takes.
Oh, I had almost forgotten about him. Mostly because I don't live in Austin anymore.
Okay, you were there when it was cool. Nighthawks episode
145.
Regarding 145.
145.
Which is not the Bill and Ted episode that is still trapped as my alarm, thanks to my Echo. This episode is about the movie Relic, which is about one thing in a museum that's not actually a relic. It's a dumb name. 3, 2, 1.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. It's been a while. How are you? This is the Nighthawks podcast, the cinema-centric podcast for folks who like to stay up late, not on any kind of regular schedule. And while they're staying up late, they talk about movies. Sucking down cups of coffee in our conceptual Nighthawks diner. Here tonight is myself, your co-host, Trevor T. Trujillo. And joining me, as always,
is Matt, the other guy.
Yes.
And my cat in a non-speaking role.
I, too, have a cat and a dog who might be appearing on the podcast, depending on how crazy I want to get with the edit. Just by way of some housekeeping, folks, we know it's been a while. We know that our absence was unannounced and unexpected. It was unexpected for us as well. Life has just been kind of getting in the way lately. Things have been kind of crazy. Jobs are changing. Moves are happening. Things are happening. I am a new dad of a kid who still requires a lot of medical appointments, things like that. So we just have not been around lately. But we did have some time clear up this week. So we decided to slam dunk an episode. We don't know when we'll be back. We don't know what things are going to look like moving forward. But hopefully there's some light at the end of the tunnel and we'll get back on a regular schedule. But we did want to touch base with y'all by virtue of doing something since we had the time.
We've essentially chosen a movie at random.
Basically, I ran down the list of just what was easily accessible on Amazon, which is one of the streaming options I have left right now. I've kind of done a great purge of many of our streaming services. And I said, Matt, how do all of these hit you? And we landed on one. We have decided to cover 1997's The Relic, not to be confused with Relic from a few years ago, which was this is a...
Also not to be confused with the Relic of a few years ago that is a kind of an A24 artistic horror movie.
Oh, is that what that was?
Well, there's more than one. Like it's not an original title, but as far as we know, this was the first Relic.
Based on a novel by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, which has spawned a couple of series and a couple of recurring characters for them over, I think, a span of like 26 books or something like that, maybe more than that. A property that would go on to be very popular in the literary sphere, But the movie kind of failed to catch. As somebody who had read the book that this was adopted from before the movie came out, when I was very young, this was on my, I had just read Michael Crichton and devoured that, and so I was looking for things in a similar vein, and landed on The Relic, which was published, I think, in 93 or 94. Coming into this movie, I was a fan of the source novel. I was a little disappointed in the movie when I saw it, and never have gone back, so I have kind of had luck, both on the podcast and just in my general movie watching, that I've seen a lot of movies that I had initially not liked in the 90s, gone back, rewatched them, and said, hey, you know, that was actually, that was okay. Event Horizon comes to mind. That's one we watched recently for a Monstoberfest a couple of years ago, where I'm like, ah, I was kind of unfair to this when I was younger. I enjoyed my time in the Event Horizon arena. Recently, I've rewatched the Scream series and found that I enjoyed a couple of those more than I had given myself credit for originally. And so I was kind of hoping for that kind of luck on The Relic. Matt, did you see this in the 90s when it came out? Was this a movie you were familiar with?
Proximate to it coming out. I don't quite remember if I went to the theater and saw this or if I rented it, but I watched it. I remember being pretty into it. My impression of it met the burden of proof. You know, it was over 50% positive. In retrospect, like rewatching it, literally everything I remembered about it was from the last half hour. But we were kind of just talking about dying, you know, is the process of big budget adaptions, because this is a fairly successful novel. And are they doing that as much now, you know? And we were talking about that, and this was a movie that got brought up, and we were both like, I don't think I've rewatched that in 20 years, man. Maybe we should give it another chance, you know?
Yeah. Well, and specifically what we were talking about was movies that, you know, for better or worse, really departed from their source novel. The two examples I think I kind of threw out there were both Spielberg movies, but they were Jaws and Jurassic Park respectively. And Jurassic Park, although no shade, I love the original Jurassic Park, the movie, 30 years old. Listen to our Jurassic Park episode. It's a good one. I love Jurassic Park. But the movie and the book are two totally separate entities. They have like a same core theme, a couple of characters in common. But as far as actual plot, as far as events depicted on screen versus depicted on the page, there's not a lot of similarity. There's not even a lot of similarity to the structures of either of them. It's basically just the setting and very basic premise are the same. And we were asking, it's like, I was kind of struggling to come up with an example of what is a novel that has been adapted that they really monkeyed with, whether it was well-received or not. And I was kind of saying, I think in the days since Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, where people were really comparing source material to what ends up on screen, I don't think you can get away with that as much anymore.
We were also just like, you know, we started going through factually, like how many recent movies are based on a novel. And part of what we learned is that we just don't read adult contemporary novels that get adapted into she Netflix dramas. And then the other thing, like White Noise and Killers of the Flower Moon, those are based on novels, but we haven't read the books. So
I did read Killers of the Flower Moon, and I think Scorsese is going to do a bang-up job. I'm really looking forward to that. But yeah, go ahead.
We also got to talking about how a lot of stuff, you know, stuff we'd like to see given a treatment, it has been getting turned into series.
Altered Carbon is a good example of that. God, they keep tiptoeing around Sandman Slim series. A couple people have been attached to that here and there over the years. I don't know if that's still something they're going through with. And then probably the one most recent example that we've talked about was there was an adaptation of a Ace Adkins Spencer novel that got made into a movie, but neither of us had read that novel either.
I had read that novel, but you got to get about halfway through Spencer Confidential before you go, wait a minute, is this that novel? Like, and Ace Atkins had some strong things to say about that, and I'm like, man, just take that Wahlberg check. Don't worry about it. It's not your fault.
Anyways, folks, to that end, we're talking about a movie that's 25 years old now. We're talking about a book that's even older than that, coming up on 30 years. we're probably going to be talking about spoiler elements of both the movie and the book, and maybe some of the subsequent books in the series. So if those are something you want to hit cold, maybe hit this episode afterwards. But at this point, I really don't want to encumber us with a spoiler curtain. And my reaction to this movie is not strong enough that I really want to preserve anything for a viewer. I don't know if even at the end of the episode, I'm 100% going to recommend this movie. So just knowing that going in, otherwise, stick around. We're going to have a good time.
Trevor, are you saying that we're not doing a spoiler curtain because of the age of the movie? Because the movie is something of a relic?
Oh! Well done. Well done. Man, they really had to shoehorn the word relic into this script, didn't they?
Almost heard the MST3K bots yelling, "We have title."
But anyways, the movie The Relic concerns a, let's see, how do I synopsize this? A brain-eating monster that is loose in the Chicago Field Museum, and it is kind of up to a scientist, anthropologist, and a Chicago City lieutenant on the police force to kind of get to the bottom of some of these mysterious happenings around the museum. Some people are dead, some people are munched, and it's all happening on the precipice of the opening of this great exhibit on the supernatural that the museum is launching.
According to museum security, you were the last one to leave last night. Did you see or hear anything strange?
Well, I thought I heard something as I was leaving, but it could have been anything.
Sweeping teams of two. Nobody goes in alone. This place is not going to open until every room is clear. I'll go.
Come out, wherever you are.
Any idea about a weapon?
Something big.
The board is hosting a gala preview here tomorrow night. It would be a disaster for us if we had to postpone.
We may have somebody on our hands who makes Jeffrey Dahmer look like a Cub Scout.
You have to let the gala go on. Something's wrong.
Come on, what's the matter with you?
Sapien.
Pardon? What are you talking about?
Gradual extinction of the human race.
And that is our story in a nutshell. And the broad strokes of that are also true of the book. A couple of early departures to discuss just right off the bat. Number one, the setting has moved. In the book, the museum is the Museum of Natural History in New York City. And there's a couple of protagonists in the book that are not utilized in the movie who go on to be very instrumental in the series as they go on. But, Matt, how did this leave you just out of the gate here?
Very mid.
Yeah?
Like I said, everything I remembered as being cool from the movie is in the last half hour, 45 minutes. And it felt interfered with. They show the expedition to titular MacGuffin and bring it back from, you know, an unspecified dark continent. I think it's later revealed to be Brazil.
That is such a weird scene. Like,
yeah, and it's a very, there's an anthropologist that looks like Indiana Jones, and
he's going through some kind of weird ayahuasca ceremony.
Strange, like, yeah, he does a psychedelic ceremony and then learns something about this tribe, and they make a very light attempt to conceal it from the audience, and then fairly quickly blow what was a big reveal in the book, right? I could have done without that whole scene. I could have had them just start when Dr. Green pulls up to the museum. And if they use that material at all, use it in flashbacks, you know. I thought the first part, the first killing happens at the museum, and then there's a fairly drawn out first act where the hard-bitten cop played by Tom Sizemore, he's investigating the museum, and this had a lot of like pretty kind of goofy foreshadowing. Like, they really want you to know that the homicide detective is superstitious, you know? There are a few things like that that they just were ponderous. There's an academic rivalry subplot between our female lead, Dr. Green, and another scientist that she's competing with for a grant. And the only payoff for that probably 10 minutes of setup is it endures her to her grad students and later explains why she's making a speech at the gala, which she didn't need a rival to be trying to get money. So it doesn't, like, it's just wasted runtime, you know? It's just a whole subplot that could have been dropped.
There was a lot of setup here that was not paid off. Like, there's a lot of stuff here it's just extraneous plot dialogue. And for instance, Tom Sizemore is very superstitious. That is an element that is unique to the movie. That is not from the source material. But I'm like, okay, so we've got this museum. They're doing an exhibit on superstition. The big bad in this movie is a creature of superstitious origin. Okay, we have a superstitious detective. I'm on board. But they don't do anything with it.
It lines up some discussion between, like, she's more of a Scully type. And her mentor is more of the midpoint. He feels like that superstitions and folktales can give you like valid starting point. Like if a tribe uses something for tribal medicine, there might be something of benefit to Western medicine encoded there somewhere. And you should take the tribal practice seriously. It does spark a little bit of debate and discussion that sort of characterizes them. But why do that when then you strip overall plot down to a pretty basic creature in the basement movie? And then when we finally get to the big fundraising gala, which is like very heavily foreshadowed, and you know by about minute 30 that this creature's going to attack during the gala, right? And that's when we finally kind of get down to business, and we have, I thought of you as I watched it, because I was like, oh, this once they're on the run from the creature and they're forced into the catacombs, the basements of the museum, and then
the old
sewers and substructure into the city.
Yeah.
Which in the New York setting of the novel has a bit more expansive of a history than the Chicago infrastructure, which was not, you know, you can definitely go urban exploring in either one, but New York subways are infamous for being sprawling and lost. When that all got down to business, I was like, oh, this is very Poseidon Adventure, actually.
Because yes.
Then you have the scene with, like, the one character has some accessibility problems, and there's a bunch of very Poseidon Adventure beats in it.
Yes, but absolutely. I agree. No, this is almost somebody got Jurassic Park rolled into a ball with Night at the Museum and then, you know, put on a soupçon of Poseidon Adventure for the third act, and that's basically this movie.
Well, and then the main structural change from the book, and I get moving the setting because maybe the Field Museum cooperated with them more than the, you know, maybe there were practicalities involved in where they shot it.
Mm-hmm.
New York was still so torn up from Ghostbusters, you know. But hi, Bo. But the main thing is that the main character of the series of novels is written out of this. And we had quite a bit of a little side chat about that before we filmed the episode, or before we recorded this, because you pointed out that he's all but Sherlock Holmes, right? He's an 80s, 90s Sherlock Holmes. And, like, I came out and called him, you know, he's kind of Mary Sue-ish, and I see why they might have, because he's a independently wealthy guy who still works for the FBI for 80 grand a year because it amuses him. And he, you know, and he's got perfect suits and a perfect car and perfect manners, and he's a Southern gentleman and also a martial arts expert, and he speaks six languages, and, like, he's kind of the Heinlein quote about, like, a human being should be able to do, like, these 90 things because specialization is for insects, you know?
Yeah.
And I've only read one or two of these books, and I had the thought reading Relic and then reading the first, what's it, Reliquary, the first sequel.
Yeah, that's that one is a direct sequel, and then the rest of the novels just kind of characters in common come and go, and they're all kind of on the precipice of the supernatural like these are, but none of them deal, Relic and Reliquary are the only two that deal directly with the museum monster.
I almost didn't blame them for dropping him because, like, he's a good truck store novel, a projective hero. but he might be a little like all but the Pierce Brosnan James Bond. And so you would have had to find a guy like Pierce Brosnan or Robert Downey Jr., who is famously one of the better Sherlocks, you know. You would have had to find someone like that to play him. And I kind of wonder if some of that. And the other thing is, I don't necessarily believe at the time that Relic was written that they had a roadmap for a shared universe or a set of sequels.
No, I don't think so either. I've got some theories about that, but we can talk about down the road.
But you were saying the book production timeline kind of dicked with the movie because like the sequel to this came out around the time the movie dropped, right?
The sequel to the book came out the same year. But what had happened is this movie had kind of a troubled production as far as special effects go. So it went from a kind of prime release in 1996 and then ended up getting kicked back to 97, kind of early in the year when typically, especially around then. And
was this a February special?
I think so. I think they blamed it on special effects, but guys, how this left me, was not a good movie. It's
release date, January 10th, 1997.
Yeah. And so as much as we want to say that this was a production problem,
a kiss of death.
Yeah, I think it was kind of released in a shitty time because it's not a very good movie. And then the sequel book came out later that year. Well, Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, who were the authors, they're two guys working on the same series, have kind of demurred from discussing the movie in public, but it's clear that they were not fans. And I don't even know if I blame them. Even the change of setting, I think, would have been hard for them to swallow. One or the other, I can never remember. I think it was Douglas Preston he worked for the American Museum of Natural History in New York City and wrote a history book about the place. So he was very intimate. The museum politics that are discussed in the book are very present. And like he had firsthand insider knowledge of some of this stuff. And then to have it kicked over to Chicago, I'm sure didn't go down well. But then they eliminate this Pendergast character, Aloysius Pendergast, who's the FBI agent. And they eliminate, who is almost an author insert, Bill Smithback, who is a writer working on a history book for this gala event that they're kicking off. Kind of a muckraking journalist who has picked up a job writing this history book. And having both of those eliminated, and these are two characters who would go on to be key in the rest of the series, I really think after Reliquary, they intentionally spun off characters that were not either not in this movie or who were killed off in the movie and not in the book to kind of carry the torch and almost reclaim, I guess, the rights by saying our subsequent books are not going to be books that you can adapt into movies as sequels to this movie. Because we didn't like it. And so Stephen King did the same thing with Dr. Sleep, where he didn't like the Stanley Kubrick Shining, but he set characters and setting in Dr. Sleep specifically so that if they were to make it into a movie, it could not be a sequel to Kubrick's Shining. Well, obviously we know that that ended up happening with the blessing of both Stephen King and the Kubrick estate, and that's why Mike Flanagan is the incredible filmmaker he is. But I think it was kind of a similar situation here where they're like, okay, let's take the elements they didn't use and spin them out and show them how successful we could make this with those elements intact.
I got a flight of fancy for you. Maybe this is something that a studio could demand, so to speak.
Studio demands it with TC and the other guy. Fuck. Jim Brzezelek.
A Rian Johnson-helmed remake of Relic with a full-on Knives Out quality rendition of AXL Pendergast.
See, it's
Did you know that? His three initials spell Axel.
When you said Pierce Brosnan and James Bond, I immediately went to Daniel Craig as Benoit Blanc, who is not far off of Pendergast at all.
Oh, who have you brought me?
Policeman, Lieutenant D'Agosta.
Well, how goes the gradual extinction of the human race, Lieutenant?
Oh, I'm doing what I can. Keep it orderly.
You and the lieutenant are kindred spirits. He's very superstitious.
Well, I don't know about Barry.
Well, you must excuse Margot, Lieutenant. She believes that science must destroy. Nithin, as a consequence, she has very little patience with superstitious people like us. Margot, did I ever tell you about my experiences with the Kai tribe in Bechuanaland?
Yes, more than once.
Haven't told him. The Kai tribe, Lieutenant, believe that headaches were caused by sorcery. And the kinfolk of the headache victim would identify the sorcerer and then go off and murder him. Of course, the kinfolk of the sorcerer would feel they had to avenge his death, so they'd go and in turn kill the headache victim. And I'm sure you can imagine how it eventually all turned out.
What's that?
Well, it's a medical miracle. Everybody stopped having headaches. Lieutenant, what would a superstitious police officer possibly want with an old fossil like me?
He wants to know about John Whitney.
You think some connection between the vandalism of John's office and the murder?
Maybe. What's John Whitney doing in Brazil?
Well, John's an anthropologist. He's in Brazil studying ancient tribes, their rituals, their environmental and social relations, their culture.
When was the last time you heard from him?
Oh, I haven't had actual contact with him for months, but just yesterday we received a wonderful artifact.
Yeah, I took a look at it.
That artifact's rather important to me, Lieutenant, because it may help to illuminate a scientific theory I've been expounding for some time, the Callisto effect.
What's that?
It's a commonly held belief that life evolved gradually by natural selection. Dr. Frock argues that sometimes there are sudden evolutionary changes that create a grotesque and short-lived aberrant species.
Okay, so John Whitney's down in Brazil studying ancient tribal rituals. Could any of these rituals have anything to do with, say, ripping out the human hypothalamus?
Beg your pardon?
Human hypothalamus?
Okay, while Trevor's walking his dog, let's talk about something stupid in this movie. When they don't have any weapons to fight the creature indoors during the climax, the scientist, Dr. Green, she suggests that because it is cold-blooded, they fight it with liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen, it don't matter. If you're a reptile, if you get hit with liquid nitrogen does not care about genus or species. Oh, Trevor's back. Okay, that can just be a little Easter egg. But yeah, so just like, oh yeah, like X percentage of its DNA is from cold-blooded reptiles, so it's vulnerable to liquid nitrogen. But that wouldn't even make sense in Dungeons and Dragons. Like, everything's vulnerable to liquid nitrogen unless it's made out of rocks. And also, they play a lot of games with like the DNA synthesis and stuff, like the machine that slowly, suspensefully decodes the DNA, and it's like 32% gecko and 19% skunk ape and 32% Mothman. And like, they don't give you like a breakdown, or like everybody would be 99% chimp, you know? That's why you do it like they do it in Prince of Darkness, where they're just like, we made this shit up. But no, that's actually my main criticism of this movie, is that it offers very little that's super unique. Like, the whole time I was thinking, oh, I could be watching The Thing, The Void, Mimic, you know, Deep Rising, Deep Blue Sea, The Reef, The Reef 2, Jaws, Jaws 2, Orca.
And this is honestly my suspicion, Matt. This movie is clearly... the studio said, hey, we need to get ourselves a Jurassic Park. So let's find ourselves a tech novel or a techno thriller. We'll adapt that. And the important elements of this to them were the monster and the chase. So what we had in the novel was a monster story, but it's really more of an investigation. It's them trying to figure out what is posited in the movie by just a digital test. It's them wandering around doing detective work. It's DaGosta as the sidekick for Pendergast, and they're trying to figure things out, and Margot is kind of their technical advisor on issues involving the museum. What we get in the movie is, as you point out, kind of a disaster story with a lot of clunky exposition that's not really a mystery as much as it's a police procedural. In the book, I remember there's a lot of to-do about whether or not a wild animal is being kept in the museum as kind of a conspiracy, or that a wild animal has found its way into the museum and the museum is so expansive that it can just exist there. And it gives into kind of urban legend, which feeds into this superstition thing. And there's also this subplot about whether or not the museum should even be doing a superstition exhibition, whether or not it's sensational and against the scientific mission of the museum to pander to the lowest common denominator and do this exhibition in the first place, which is then kind of coupled by the book that this Smithback character is writing. You know, he's trying to write the story, warts and all, scandalized people in the past. There's been some collection methods in years past that weren't exactly flattering for the museum. And the museum's trying to silence that. They're trying to censor those parts of his book. So there's a lot going on here about sensationalism versus academia, and that it's, you really can go too far in one direction or the other. And none of that is present here. It's basically police procedural for 2/3 of the movie. Then we have Poseidon Adventure with a dinosaur at the end. It's almost enough of a unique movie where I don't know that they would have needed the license. Like, I don't know that they retained as much of the book as they could have, that they didn't have to pay for it. I just, sometimes these things boggle my mind. I don't understand why some decisions were made. But even approaching this as a non-purist for the book, like, it's been 25 years since I've read the book. I'm pretty far removed from it.
The other thing is, like, there are little snippets of all those subplots left in the movie. Like, there are a few quick conversations about, you know, the suspicion stuff, and but they don't go anywhere, and they aren't followed up on, and they aren't of any real value, you know? They just clutter the movie. And so they also didn't take a scalpel and just excise the concept they actually wanted of the museum beast, you know? So it really reads like it was, you know, like a too many cooks situation.
Well, and there are, in addition to Preston Child, who were credited with writing the original book, there were, I think it was, I looked this up and sent it to our group chat, but like 4 credited writers on this. And 2 of them seem to be folks who work together. So I think they brought them together as a team. And that is Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver. And they have some pretty good credits to their name. They have their name on scripts for Avatar: Way of Water, Jurassic World, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Like, those guys have some good credits. One of the other writers on this, John Raffo, before this did Dragon the Bruce Lee Story, and then did one movie after this called Johnny Skidmarks, which I know nothing about, and then has not had anything credited since then. And then the 4th writer is Amy Holden Jones, only has a few credits after this. A lot of it is TV and kind of a creator position, but she seems to have been the origin of the Beethoven St. Bernard movies. And previous to Relic had such hits as Mystic Pizza, Indecent Proposal, and a big favorite of my teenage years, The Slumber Party Massacre. And then the director is all over the place. He did the really bad Ray Bradbury adaptation for Sound of Thunder. He did the really bad adaptation of The Three Musketeers in The Musketeer. Then he also has a couple of good movies. He has Stay Tuned, which I say is one of the more incredible comedies of the 90s that goes unsung, with John Ritter and Pam Dauber when they get sucked into the devil's television. And then you've got Narrow Margin, the Gene Hackman movie, On a Train. That's really good. You've got Schwarzenegger, End of Days, which is kind of middling. And then you've got Jean-Claude Van Damme's films, Sudden Death and Time Cop. So the director's a little all over the place too. But I think my note for this is that this movie is just over-manufactured. This is Hollywood kind of churning out a Hollywood movie according to Hollywood formula. And so we get Penelope Ann Miller, we get Tom Sizemore, you know, a couple of actors who are good looking and, you know, not unheard of. You've got your Jurassic Park setup. That's pretty successful. You've got Stan Winston doing the practical creature effects, which are very good in this, although I don't know how well the creature is utilized. And unfortunately, I think it just kind of failed its license. Now, I don't know how obligated this movie should have been to that license. I don't know how much better or worse a faithful adaptation of Relic on the screen would have been in 1996 or 1997. But I just know as a fan of the book, I was not impressed. And even just as a monster movie, I wasn't particularly impressed.
Yeah, the monster in this is good when it finally gets down to business. It's kind of a cool design. But they really do the don't show the monster trick here to conserve how much it's actually in frame. Almost to the point that you're like, oh, could they not actually afford to use it as much as they wanted?
Well, and then there's some really dodgy CGI in this. Which yeah, is just, and that's a product of the 90s, but
it dips in and out of CGI and dips in and out of quality. Conversely, like there's a really good, the part where it beheads the SWAT cop, that's a pretty good beheading, but then you move on a little bit and like the cringy tongue part, that's one of the, that looked like something out of Reboot, you know?
Yeah. You know, and it's funny that you bring that up because even like in my most piggish adolescent teen years, I saw that scene and went, man, they're really taking care of the guy whose hand is in that glove, in the tongue puppet. Like, because there's a scene where Penelope Ann Miller's Dr. Green is kind of pinned down in a closet, and the creature is just outside, and his long reptilian tongue comes up and just licks her sternum from top to bottom a couple of times. I misidentified that effect as being practical when I was a kid. It's pretty obviously CG in this, and it's really bad CG.
And I think, like I'm going to operate on the principle of charity, and I think the point of that was to hammer home the big reveal that the creature used to be a person, which is the big, like, over the plot of this, we reveal that the titular relic that's supposed to be missing, right, doesn't exist. Because what they find is this crate, and all it's got in it is the packing material. And we learn that the packing material was actually a leaf that will transform things that eat it into bestial brain-seeking monsters. And the tribe it was taken from used to have a warrior eat it, and then they would transform into a monster. The attacking tribe would then hide. The monster would eat their enemy's brains and then die for lack of, because it needs more human hypothalamus every few days or whatever. And so the monster would then quit, the bioweapon basically would quickly die off.
I think the idea is that there is a fungus on these leaves that contains a chemical that is also found in the thalamus, in the human brain. And so without access to these leaves, the creature becomes homicidal, zeroes in on the nearest brain, and starts snacking on people's heads. So if you get this thing addicted to your leaf fungus, have it transform under the properties of said leaf, you can then drop, you said it, it's a bioweapon. You send it into the neighboring village and he eats all of their brains.
And in the book, they sort of deal with the kind of thing-like implications of the fact that, like, if it gets loose in New York City, it will never run out of brains.
Right.
Right? It's not just going to go kill another village or tribe of 10 people and then die of starvation. There's a lot of technobabble in this, and it's real bad, like Star Trek original series reverse the tachyons technobabble. So those little gritty details get kind of lost in there. At the end of the day, it's a monster killing people in the bowels of a giant spooky building, and you're either in or out for that, And it wasn't precisely bad, but it was like something that we're like, I certainly wouldn't want to buy a 2023, $14 movie ticket to go see it for a dollar rental at Hastings, and then we're going to go get some. We're going to go get some hamburger stand and go home and eat junk food and watch a horror movie. It was an acceptable PG-13 horror movie, But the whole time I was like, wow, I would really rather be watching Mimic, The Void, The Thing.
Yeah, I thought of The Mimic several times, which is that old Guillermo del Toro movie, which I didn't love back then either, but I really need to give another watch. I think that's one that I might have changed my mind on.
I rewatched that, I don't quite remember when, but since the, you know, long march of 2019, that's still nominally ongoing, and I thought it held up very well.
Well, and
it has a few, I will say it has one key scare in it that was that an unfortunate decision was made to do it with the CGI of the time. That of everything else in the movie, if one shot in that movie was practical, it should have been this particular shot. But other than that, it held up pretty darn good. It's no Ghost Ship, you know, but there's so many monster in the sewer movies and stuff that this just did not stand out from the pack. It did not live up from the book. I don't know.
Well, and then you start thinking about other movies that came out at the time, like Species was another one where you have the ensemble chasing after a subterranean monster, you know, that had an overtly sexual component to it. And this was just done, you know, this was kind of a done creature movie. Anaconda was another one that came out round about this time that was just a bad CG monster movie that didn't quite live up to the hype. And so when I watched this, I was fairly pissed about the departures from the book and kind of left it at that. And when I was coming into it this time, I was really hoping for, you know, maybe this is just a serviceable monster movie. Maybe if I abandon, you know, my fandom and if I leave my expectations at the door. But no, it's really generic. Up to and including that they have this weird subplot about Tom Sizemore's character, Vincent D'Agosta, going through a divorce where he's losing custody of his beloved dog. Which sort of pays off later because there is like a tracking dog that they're trying to find the monster with that ends up getting separated from his owner when the owner gets separated from his head. And Tom Sizemore comes in and rescues the dog. And I guess that's some kind of payoff for that. But there is just so much extraneous bullshit in this that is there because it's a trope.
7 decapitations in 1 week. Don't you just hate someone who only takes head and never gives it?
You're bad, Matilda. Real bad.
Autopsy attended by Lieutenant Vincent D'Agosta, Chicago homicide. I heard your ex got custody of the dog.
What's on the goddamn internet?
You shouldn't have been late on your Alpo payments. We have an African-American male, probably age 55 to 60, height 5'4", with his head, maybe 6'1", weight 160, give or take, if you know what I mean. There are an undetermined number of lacerations proceeding from the left anterior pectoral region downward through the sternum, terminating at the right anterior abdominal region. The pectoralis minor and pectoralis major are separated to a great degree, and there is spontaneous dehiscence. The sternal process has been split, and the rib cage exposed. Now for the head. The head is decapitated between the axial process and the atlas. The entire occipital portion of the calvarium and half the parietal process has been crushed, or rather seemingly punched through and removed, leaving a hole perhaps 5 inches in diameter. The skull is empty. The entire brain appears to have fallen out or been extracted through this hole.
Any idea about a weapon?
Something big. The brain is severely traumatized and appears to have been severed at the medulla oblongata. The pons veruli is intact but separate. The cerebrum has been completely severed from the mesencephalon and, hey, wait a minute, this brain's light, even for a man. Something's missing, Lieutenant. Where's the rest of it?
You got everything we found.
There is no thalamic region. There is no pituitary gland.
What are you talking about?
The thalamus and hypothalamus regulate body temperature, blood pressure, heartbeat. It regulates hundreds of hormones into the bloodstream. Don't you agree, Fred?
Yes.
He never shuts up.
There is so much writing in here that is so generic. Like, there's a couple of kids who, in a scene in the book, there are two children who are brutally murdered when they wander kind of into the employees-only area of the museum. And in the movie, I think the kids make it. It's implied that they survive. But they are kind of left behind when they decide to quote-unquote cut class and go to the museum and stay after hours. And the first line as we cut to the children after the museum is closed is one of the kids saying, "I don't think we should be here." And then 2 seconds later, an announcement comes over the loudspeaker. The museum is now closed. And it's like, we didn't need both of those lines. That generic as hell, and it takes me out of the movie, and you just told me he doesn't belong there with the loudspeaker recording. Like, I get it. This movie is really pandering.
It's like the thing with DaCosta being superstitious. Like, he tells one really gripping story about why he's superstitious and why he has a lucky bullet. And it's because his like first week as a cop, he goes to help a guy that locked himself out of his car. And it turns out the guy is a car thief breaking into the car, and he shoots him at close range, and the bullet does not go off. And it's only because of that lucky bullet that misfired on him, which he goes out of his way to explain is a perfectly normal bullet with nothing wrong with him, right? And so as someone who has read the book, at the end of the book, Pendergrass makes a clutch shot and hits the creature in the eye. And so I'm thinking, oh, they're setting up, he's going to run out of ammunition and not have any reloads for his old chief special, and he's going to use his lucky bullet, you know.
Yeah.
No payoff. And then instead of just having him like one time, like he tells a rookie not to step over a dead body because it's unlucky, which you don't not do that because it's unlucky. You don't do that because you don't want
to
shed forensics on a crime scene, right? And instead of just having one quick establisher that he's superstitious and then he tells the story, there have to be five or six things that he does in the, like, he's almost like the guy in R.L. Stein wrote one good adult horror novel called Luck. And it's about a dude that has to comply with superstitions, or he mutates and attacks people. And it reminded me of that because it has to be like a six beat thing. Just have him like kiss his St. Christopher's medal, have him tell the lucky bullet story, and, you know, and then have the payoff, you know. And they do that a lot in here. Like, they hit the dog thing a bunch of times. They hit the people mispronounced Augusto's name.
What the hell was that? Like, that didn't make any sense to me.
And the weird Donald Trump mayor that's like obsessed with his own wife's boobs. that felt like a character from the Ghostbusters, you know, because that used to be kind of a valid caricature, you know. And I think that was all either Ed Koch or Donald Trump, you know, back in the day when Donald Trump could walk in a straight line. Clamp in Gremlins 2 is kind of a pot shot at Donald Trump. And
well, and that character, I will say this entire movie is kind of a miasma of recognizable character actors. This movie took me a long time to actually get through today because I kept stopping it and going, now I've seen that guy before. Where is he? The guy who's playing the mayor is Robert Lesser, who you'll probably most handily remember as Bonnie Bedelia's really dickhead coworker in Die Hard. But I will always remember him as being the guy who sends Santa Claus to jail in Ernest Saves Christmas. And so this guy just has a career of playing an unbelievable dickhead, and does so in this movie as well. There is also just a lot of Hollywood jockeying for, like, a police lieutenant does not have the authority to shut down the Field Museum of Chicago indefinitely, which is a thing here. And then the mayor does not have the power to override that detector, that lieutenant, to reopen it. And there's a lot of that kind of, like, yardsticking going on in city politics, and none of it comes off as plausible or realistic. Another thing that this movie does really, I don't fully understand it, but they move the timeline for this. Like, the book takes place over a course of several months, I think. And then the movie, expressly from the time we have the fake Indiana Jones doing the ayahuasca ceremony to the Margot pulling up to the museum in the beginning, we're talking 7 weeks. And the events of the movie all kind of take place over the course of 24 hours, which really works against this movie. There is, I don't think there would have been anything wrong with the plot taking in-movie time for things to unfold, so it's not quite as madcap and not quite as overstuffed. And you'd have more time to develop those things, those little character ticks that it was playing with. But at this stage, it just feels so rushed. And I really think it was because they were trying to get to that Irwin Allen Towering Inferno Poseidon Adventure conclusion, which I think you very easily could have, like, if that's the part of the movie you wanted to do, that could have been the whole movie. We could have exposited just through, like, if we start the movie at people arriving for this gala, and then slowly and surely they start getting picked off, and the security system, and this happens in the movie, the security system locks everybody in the building. That's your setup. That's your fucking movie, is people locked in a museum with a monster. And we can totally excise the investigation part of this, which is what they seem to have wanted to do anyway. But the fact is we have 2/3 of this movie that is just aimless, overstuffed, expository crap. Most of it doesn't get paid off, and none of it you really need to get to the monster at the end of the book.
This movie was shorter than it felt, because I looked at it and the actual runtime isn't that long. But I was going, like, this could, like, so much of this could be, like, this is a much better movie. Yeah, I mean, because if you just start with that first murder, or killing, I don't know, is it murder when a lizard thing... Lizard side?
He's still 45% human, I think. So I think it counts.
Well, no, because that's the other thing is, like, why do they have the DNA of the employees?
I
haven't been able to think about that since you asked me.
Yeah, basically all of the reveal happens because this department has a really fast DNA analysis machine that will break down a piece of DNA and say, you are looking at bug DNA, you were looking at cockroach DNA, you're looking at whatever. And it also seems to be able to separate DNA and say, your sample comprises 5% gecko, 6% bumblebee, 45% human, and that human piece also is one of the museum employees, which we also have their DNA on file for no good reason.
10% brundle, 90% fly.
Yeah.
I also was thinking during that part of the movie, like, I could just be watching The Fly.
We would have been better off just watching The Fly. So, Matt, overall, like, you know, it breaks my heart just to rag on this movie. And especially since people, on, you know, over social media have brought this up from time to time as kind of a slept on pretty good monster movie. I'm not there with it. Like, it's fine. I didn't get antsy while watching it. I wasn't super keen to turn it off and do something else. Like, it was fine for what it was. It did have trouble kind of holding my attention from time to time. I had to kind of stop myself from doing other things or looking at my phone or whatever. But I think it's fine. It's fine. It's generic. And I don't know that I need to watch this again anytime soon. I don't hate that I did. But, you know, if I hadn't watched it again, I probably would have been okay. I think I remain totally unfazed and unchanged by this.
I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to call Trevor up and yell at him the way I would if we, like, you know, if we'd watched Manos, The Hands of Fate or something. You know? I mean, this is a finished movie. It's fine.
Leonard Maltin gave this 2.5 out of 4 stars, called it Alien in a Museum. Ebert and Siskel gave it positive reviews. Ebert called it surprisingly entertaining. Siskel called it actually a lot of fun if you like special effects and gore, combining conventions of the horror and disaster genres. All of that checks out for me. I'm not sure if I'm as on board with the effects and gore as Siskel was, but the practical effects, when utilized, looked pretty good. I just wish they had utilized them more.
Well, that's the thing, is there's a little bit of a doughiness to this. It's not quite an Indiana Jones adventure movie, and it's not quite a straight enough horror movie. I think you hit the nail on the head when you said this is somebody that wanted a Jurassic Park. Play the grace notes and get away with it, you know? You know what else it reminded me of is The Replacement Killers. Yeah, with kind of the emphasis on the, you know, the city's architecture and stuff. And Replacement Killers is a very kind of kind of urban landscape porn movie, you know? Like, I would definitely never recommend, like, tell anybody, oh, you got to watch this. And I can't recommend it to, like, I can't see a horror purist being impressed with it because it's not really enough of a horror movie to hold their attention, you know? And it's not really, like, it's not a kid-friendly adventure movie like a Jumanji or something like that. So it's kind of like, who's this for? Like a bland couples movie with just a nice couple of jump scares to get your date over into the seat next to her, you know?
Well, I'll tell you what. If Jurassic Park is Scream, then this is the Urban Legends 2 to Jurassic Park. It's like, yeah, it's more of the same. If you like that thing, it's the same thing, but not as good, you know? Just if you want it. You can't wait for The Lost World to come out. We got this.
Yeah, you want Land Before Time? You know, there's 34 of those. I mean, I guess, you know, James Wan makes some PG-13 horror movies, but they're not like this. This was like, it's weird because it's like trying to be grounded and broad enough to that non-genre audiences will watch it, which is the quality it had in common with Jurassic Park, right? But much like, you know, we've discussed with Jurassic Park's own sequels, it misses the sense of wonder. So I don't know. It's just not.
First,
you know?
Liquefy and purify my sample. Then this machine will amplify the DNA strand. And finally scan the created gel image. Then it's matched against a huge database we've compiled over the last 3 years.
Very impressive. How long is this going to take?
A little while.
Oh, that's terrific.
What have you got there?
Good luck, bullet.
Superstitious, I remember now.
Yeah.
So does your bullet have a story?
I was on the beat my rookie year, and I saw this guy who locked his keys in his car with his motor running. He's got a clothes hanger, and he's trying to get the lock off. So I go over and try to help him out, and what I didn't know was that he just robbed the liquor store a block away. So he's concentrating so hard, you know, so he doesn't see me till I'm right up on top of him. I surprise him, turns, and point blank range. Doesn't pop, though. Doesn't go off. This bullet.
So what did you do?
Took the gun away from him and beat the shit out of him. Anyway, the forensics told me later that bullet's perfect. Should have fired. I should be dead.
So in other words, a miracle of physics.
Maybe just plain old-fashioned good luck.
There is one quote currently extant on the Douglas Preston Lincoln Child website about the movie, and that's really all that is kind of being said about it. And it's in their Frequently Asked Questions section, and the question is, what did you think of the movie version of Relic? The answer reads, quote, "Let us just say that we are still hoping to see an excellent movie or TV series featuring the character of AXL Pendergast, who has yet to grace the screen." So with that in mind, Matt, is this something that should be re-examined or remade? I know we both kind of started rereading the book as we were discussing doing this episode. Neither of us have finished it yet. But just kind of based on what you remember and what you're reading so far, is this something that needs to grace the screen? Is this something that would be a good adaptation, or is it something probably best left to literature?
I'm actually genuinely shocked that there hasn't been some kind of, if not Relic per se, that there hasn't been like a Pendergast and Co.
series or something.
TV series or something, because... like for a while there, they were cranking out a lot of those, like the Magicians and the Librarians, and so there was plenty of call for some kind of urban fantasy there.
Well, and for as much as there is a lot of Holmes and Watson action between Pendergast and Vincent D'Agosta, later in the series, Pendergast kind of picks up a little goth girl who is his sidekick for a while and for a couple of books, who I think would be very marketable for a TV series.
Yeah, so no, I think this one's ripe for a do-over.
Man, how are you going to have... Okay, so the whole dynamic of the book is that we've got Pendergast, who is the lead FBI investigator, and Vincent D'Agosta, who is his local kind of sidekick. Then in the movie, we have Vincent D'Agosta, who is the lead investigator, and they give him a sidekick. They wrote a sidekick in for him. Just make that guy Pendergast. Like, I don't know. There are some curious calls made in this adaptation. But, yeah, I'd like to see another bite at this apple. I'd like to see Pendergast at some point. But, you know, as you were kind of talking about him being a little Mary Sue or Gary Stewish, I couldn't refute you. I kind of got ready to scrum up and defend these books that I've enjoyed and read. And I'm like, no, you know what? Pendergast was never the draw for me. He's a fun character, and I enjoy reading the books about him. But mostly what I am looking for in those books are his side characters and just the set pieces that are really fun and impressive. And so I really even couldn't refute the fact that, yeah, he is kind of a perfect polymath, definitely a character that you have to buy into. You know, he's not somebody you're going to find really existing out in the world, but neither is Hannibal Lecter. So, but I would like to see an attempt at this. This was not it.
The insufferable guy works better is in a TV series where he's got some people around him.
Yeah.
You know what one I've started watching? It's called Surreal Estate. It's a horrible pitch. It is a real estate agency that deals exclusively with haunted houses.
Uh-huh.
It had Tim Rose on, who is like Diet Coke Timothy Oliphant.
That's Josh Duhamel.
He's the Timothy Oliphant of Canada. And he appears alongside Mrs. McMurray in the Wynonna Earp show, right?
Oh, okay.
And so I watched a bunch of that, and it got pitched to me as related. And I'm like, this is surprisingly not bad for what it is. Because it's this very nice little episodic supernatural show where, like, they have to kind of solve the hauntings to get them to move on so they can sell the house.
Oh, that's
and I'm like, you know what I miss? Yeah. They fix the houses so they can sell them when no one else can sell them. And then the real estate agency is sort of the front for their paranormal investigation team. Like, it gives them, and so they have the money for the gear and the reason to be in the house, and their accesses of skepticism and stuff vary quite a bit. It is a surprisingly fun little cheap show, you know. But it did make me, I don't know if I actually liked it or if I just liked the fact that, like, oh, this is just an episodic TV show. Every week Cheyenne rides into a different town.
Right.
And he deals with a different gunfighter. And, you know.
Well, and you and I were also talking. Another thing I've been doing is a rewatch of Justified ahead of the new limited series or the new season, whatever you're going to call it. We've got another season of Justified coming, folks. As much as I love that show, speaking of Timothy Oliphant, it is really just an episodic fugitive of the week. We have some recurring themes and some overarching stories to tell. But really it is, again, just Have Gun, Will Travel or Cheyenne, you know? By design, it's a TV Western, you know?
Oh, yeah. And if it has a flaw, it's that it alternates a little bit between too much seriousness versus him doing things you could never actually, you know, like, and I will say, to their credit, he does eventually get in actual trouble with the Marshal Service.
Yeah.
Which they don't usually bother having happen in a show, you know.
The whole series of Justified kicks off when the main character, Raylan Givens, kills somebody in the line of duty. And there's a discussion of, well, did he bait him into it? Was this a justified killing? We have title. But that hangs over his head for the entire, like, rest of the two seasons. They're still bringing up, yeah, you know, you're still under investigation for killing that one guy, and you've got four more bodies under your belt. Like, you got to knock this shit off.
But it's just nice to have some TV where there's no meta plot, you know? I'm kind of spinning my wheels. Should we do what'd you give this a numerical score?
Oh, you know, it's as much as it can be fun to trash on a movie, and we've certainly done that. There are parts of this that are okay, but I'll put it over the hump and call this a straight up 55 out of 100. Like, it's just over the line. It is watchable. It's fine for what it is. It is not memorable. It is very forgettable. It is very generic and is not anything important that you have to watch. It's just kind of there. It's in the liminal space. It's a curiosity if you're a fan of these books. And I do recommend the books. As much as I have to concede that Pendergast is a bit of a Mary Sue, they are fun reads. They're fun beach reads. They're just a tier above a truck stop novel. They've got some teeth to them, some fun science, some fun techno thriller kind of aspects, some references to Lovecraft, references to Sherlock Holmes, references to, you know, cool stuff that you're not going to get in a normal Penny Dreadful.
Isn't his full name? Isn't the L in AXL for Leng, which is a Lovecraft reference?
Thanks. Leng plays into the Pendergast story. I don't know if it's his middle name, but there is a character of Enoch Leng who is very much a Victorian Sherlock Holmes style bad guy, kind of a la Moriarty for Pendergast that comes up in Cabinet of Curiosities, which is probably my favorite of the series. But yeah, I recommend those. Other than that, this is really a footnote of a movie, but I'm glad that I was able to watch it with you and do this episode for our listeners, especially in this time when, you know, we haven't been able to pump out as many episodes.
Yeah, I have to say, if I was giving it a numerical score, it left me about the same, somewhere just above the, I consider the 50%, the 49% is where it's an active, like, don't bother. But this is definitely something that, like, you could wait to catch on, like, Tubi. Like, this one, the commercial won't ruin your experience here.
There is an actual fucking cat jump scare in this. Right out of the book, cat jump scare.
Yeah, and it's one of the superstition beats, too, because the DaCosta's like, is it black?
Yeah.
there's no one here watching it with me in person. And that's the only reason I was able to go, like, oh, he would ask that. He is a Chicago cop, you know?
Well, folks, I think that's about going to wrap it up for our discussion of The Relic from 1997. My only regret is I wish we had a better movie for you tonight. But, you know, sometimes you roll the dice and you just have a fine evening. And you make it better by hanging out with friends and discussing it. That's what we do here.
Indeed.
Well, folks, find us on our social media platforms. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And as always, please subscribe to us on the podcatcher of your choosing. And if that podcatcher has the ability to leave us a rating and a review, we'd certainly appreciate that as well. But we also, Matt, have our Ko-fi account, our Ko-fi account, that you can find in our show notes. And folks, I can't stress to you how much easier it would be to get you guys these episodes in a more timely, more consistent manner if some of this operational cost was taken off of our shoulders. Right now, that's kind of the challenge we've run into is all of our edit equipment or our edit suites and stuff, they're all subscription-based. And during times of uncertain futures, I have kids and a partner to worry about now. And when the choice comes whether or not we can, you know, feed the kids or do a podcast, the kids got to come first. So,
and I have a kitty. And also, you know, like, cocaine isn't free.
But whatever our vices, whatever our situations, that would be a big help. So we will include a link to the show notes on that if there's anything you can contribute to the cause. This podcast isn't free. It costs us approximately $75 a month to produce for a full year. And some of those bills come up due all in one chunk. That is an average over the year, but, you know, we can face some pretty hefty bills, especially coming up this fall. So if that is something you can help contribute to, we would greatly appreciate it, and it would certainly make our lives easier. And once we get on a more even keel and get things rolling, we'll have some rewards and some features and things that our contributors can take part in. And you will, of course, always have our undying thanks. But Matt, that's about going to wrap it up for me. Do you have anything to add?
I was just kidding about the cocaine thing, Matt's mom. I have neither the money or the implication. It was just a comedy beat.
Yes. We're too fat to do cocaine anyways. Like, we learned our lesson. Chris Farley taught us well. Fat guys shouldn't do cocaine. Your heart's exploding.
But yeah, I think I have to go burn my copy of Relic because it's almost morning.
The book or the movie?
I meant the movie. I don't have a physical copy of the book.
I don't have physical copy of the movie either.
I have to say, it's almost morning again. Nobody as gregarious as I am should do cocaine because nobody needs like 19, 20, 21 different new business ideas explained to them in a hotel room at 3 a.m. Oh, hear me out, dude. Hear me out. It's like a hot dog. It's a hot dog, but it branches off into two hot dogs. They branch off into two hot dogs apiece, and then those branch off into two more hot dogs, and we call this motherfucker Mandelbrots. That's a nerd joke.